Let's start. Feel free to get up and get food, whatever you want to do. So I'm going to... Everyone got sheets? Okay. So I'm going to talk about the most common ethical problem that comes up pretty much every day in the hospital. It comes up where I work at Soroka Hospital. The questions of end-of-life care and how aggressively to treat patients at the end of life. Again, there's... I deal with a lot of ethical issues in my job. I wrote an article recently about mitochondrial DNA and can you make someone Jewish on the basis of that, if anyone's been following that kind of... Because mitochondrial DNA is transferred from mother to mother. So the question is, can you do that? You know, I write about artificial reproduction. I write about triage. But those, again, those are very esoteric kind of questions. But the end-of-life care is sort of the issue that comes up pretty much every day. And it's important to know what halacha would say about it. And we'll see. We'll learn. So the beginning of the handout, I'm quoting from a shoot from the Sitz Eliezer of Waldenburg, right? Everyone heard of him? Okay, he was the Rav of Shaarei Tzedek. And basically, him and Rav Moshe Feinstein were sort of the leaders of questions of medical ethics when they came up in the... And then why is the question of how aggressively to treat the end of life a modern ethical... Why didn't the Gemara talk about it, let's say, about that question? Why is that like a modern kind of question?
There wasn't anything to do.
Exactly. There was no treatment. There was nothing to do, so there was no question. So when was the first thing we were able to do something in medicine? Anyone want to... What was the first, really, where that doctors really were able to do something? Anyone want to take a guess? Penicillin in the 1920s. That was really the first thing that we had, that we were able to treat a patient. Surgeons always were able to do something, but medicine, it really came up in the penicillin in the 1920s, was the first question. So anyone know, the Ramban says in Vayikra, if anyone knows, that religious people shouldn't go to doctors, right? Does anyone know about that? Right? You've learned about that kind of thing. He says, now Rav Soloveitchik doesn't like that at all. He thinks that's a forgery, that Ramban. That the Ramban couldn't have... The first person who asked the question, the Rambam, they asked the Rambam, should you go to a doctor? He said, why? You should believe on Kadosh Baruch Hu. So the Rambam answered, what? Do you wait for your food to come to you? Do you not harvest the wheat? Do you not cook it? Do you not make it, bake bread? So just like you have to do that, you have to go to the doctors. But the Ramban writes you don't go to the doctors. So I have my own shot in the Ramban. I think the Ramban was right. Before, when the Ramban lived, doctors did harm, not good. What was the big treatment that doctors did? They did bloodletting, right? Now, is bloodletting ever a good treatment for... Very rarely. It's good for one disease. Anyone want to learn some medicine? Anyone can guess is true what bloodletting is treatment for one disease? Okay, polycythemia vera. Know that. It doesn't matter. It's leukemia. Okay, but whatever. One day you guys will learn what that is. But so George Washington died of epiglottitis. Okay? He died of epiglottitis. And there was a young doctor there who said, you know, we could save George Washington's life. We'll do a tracheostomy. And the old doctors look, are you crazy? We can't do that. We'll kill him. We have to do bloodletting. So that was absolutely the worst thing to do for a patient dying of epiglottitis, was hypoxic, to do bloodletting. So that's why maybe the Ramban said, don't go to doctors, because maybe we're just giving advice kind of thing. But till recently, there was really no treatment we could do, modern medicine, really. But then I sometimes think that they might look back at what we do and say, you know, maybe in 100 years what we do is that we really do bad things to patients. I don't know, I hope not, but you never know. You have to have a little humility in medicine too, because there's a lot of things we don't understand in medicine that you really need a lot of anava when you get into the field. Okay, so that's why it's a modern question, because there really was no treatment. So they didn't ask these questions in the shoot, because the patients died, and that was sort of it. So they asked, so the Rev Waldenberg, as a Sitz Eliezer, he wrote about 20 tshuvas on end-of-life care. And this is one of the, I'm quoting, this is one of the last ones he wrote. And then they all say the same thing. Every one of his tshuvas, it says the same thing. And we'll read in the, I'll start reading the tshuva. Yelet ha-sobel b'meshach shnatayim mi-gidul sartanei b'geza mo'ak. A child who has a brainstem cancer. Nuteach pam v'shtalal etel sinorot l'nikuzan hozlim. So when you get, you know, I usually teach my medical students, I teach medicine too, but whatever. So when you get pressure in your brain, you have to put a shunt in to relieve the pressure because you build up fluid. So you put, they put a little shunt in. Lachrona yelid me sharui b'chotzer akarat u'mechuber lachshere anshama. So this child now is in a coma. He doesn't have, he lost his consciousness and he's attached to a ventilator. V'arofim rotzim l'natcho she'nis u'ashtil b'gulgol sinorit chalufi. And then the shunt got, what happens is to relieve the pressure, they put like a shunt in the brain and then they relieve the pressure in the abdomen. So the shunt got clogged, which happens, and they want to replace it to relieve the pressure. That was sort of what the doctors wanted to do. The aim hayelit nagedet lakach mitoch hachara. So the mother refuses, I hope everyone's following me, the mother is refusing to do the operation because she says the child's dying. The child is clearly dying. He has a brainstem cancer. He's in a coma. And he's attached to a ventilator, and the mother's refusing to do the operation because just the child's dying. I don't want to increase his suffering. Let just the child die peacefully without doing another surgery. Everyone get that? Reasonable what the mother's saying, right? I mean, sound reasonable? Yeah, I mean it does. It sounds like a reasonable thing. But I mean, understand what the mother's saying. Ha'im l'fi adin yesh latet lo tipulim shu la yarichu et chayav l'zman. So they wrote to Rav Waldenberg and they said, should we do this operation or not? That was the... Now Rav Waldenberg writes in the tshuva who the name of the people are. And then, I'm not going to quote... For Rav Waldenberg, interesting, I'll tell you a story. He has about more than 20 svarim of Sitz Eliezer. 20. And... Whatever. When I started out becoming a medical ethicist, I sort of read it cover to cover. But whatever, I felt I had to read it, so it took me a while. But, so I was ready. I'm one of the, I don't know, maybe other people. I read it cover to cover, the Sitz Eliezer. Now, if you wrote a letter to the Sitz Eliezer, anyone can write him a letter. He put the letter in his book, and he put your letter, and he put his answer. So I'm reading the Sitz Eliezer cover to cover, and I get up to one where this guy writes... my daughter wants to marry this Biggest Loser who ever lived, and it's going to ruin her life. And I think this is a terrible decision. So does my daughter have to listen to me, or can she marry him even against my wishes? And it's signed a friend of mine. So my friend didn't know that this tshuva, and I know the son-in-law. I was at the wedding, so I was able to figure out by the gate of the tshuva that my friend is calling his son-in-law the Biggest Loser who ever lived. And so it was a pretty funny story. I showed it to my... Now, by the time I showed it to my friend, the sister passed away. So, because everybody, it was a little funny story. Kind of. And they're married for 30 years, and they have a very happy marriage, but my friend is still not happy about the marriage. But it was pretty... So you have to be careful when you send your shutim in that they don't get... So Sitz Eliezer just said that the daughter does not have to listen to the there's a sif in Shulchan Aruch which says a son does not have to listen to a father if he says not to marry. So the Sitz Eliezer, the same thing applies to a daughter. And I'm not telling you to do this, but that's what Sitz Eliezer says, is the daughter does not have to listen to the parents. She can choose if she wants to marry. So they wrote to the Sitz Eliezer, this couple wrote, and then so Sitz Eliezer answers, the dati da Torah bazedi. So So the Sitz Eliezer says the father is right and not the mother. You have to do the operation, and we have to do everything to save the, to let the child live longer. Ve'yema yelet chitnag del nitoch midok ha'parah shegorel b'na nechratz u'mitoch ratzon l'kar tzertziv lo lo sadka b'echlet. The mother is not right. V'achlatzat shofei peis misim b'Chicago. Okay, now you can sort of guess where. The judges said they have to listen to the mother. And that's against the Torah, that psak of the judge. Now, okay, let's just skip the paragraph. We can read the paragraph. Puchazi alach mefres b'shulchan aruch. Bring the proof. The halacha is you're allowed to mechal Shabbos for someone who is a chayisha, someone who's just not going to live. Only going to live a little longer, you're allowed to mechal Shabbos for that person. You're always allowed to mechal Shabbos. So Tzitz Eliezer says, if you're allowed to mechal Shabbos for someone who only has a few hours to live, obviously you have to treat aggressively every patient. And then he goes on. There's a machokas in the Gemara. In Yuma, why do we allow to mechal Shabbos for someone who's dying? So the Gemara gives a lot of answers. Two of the answers is mechal one Shabbos, so you mechal the mechal other Shabbos, right? Everyone get that? Because if you could save the person now, they could end up saving a lot of Shabboses. So it's worth it to mechal Shabbos. But that wouldn't apply in our case, right? Why wouldn't it apply in our case? Why would that svar apply in our case? He's dying. In fact, he might not make living to the next Shabbos. He might not make living. And he says, not as far as, because maybe they can do tshuva if you leave him alive. But this child's intubated. He's not going to do tshuva. But this is what the Sitz Eliezer says. And this is the most important line in the tshuva. Ela, mipnei, sheyesh chiyuv, kimatara bifnei atzma, lotet kiyum shel chayim, leish yehudi, velo aksarim biyoter. Because there's an independent chiyuv to extend the life of a Jew, even if it's a small time, even for the shortest amount of time. That's halacha. We always have to extend the life of a Jewish person who's dying, right? Why does the Sitz Eliezer say this? Okay, why? Because every second of life has value. It's infinite value. Life has value. We don't know Akash Baruch. We don't know how Akash Baruch values life. But every single second of life has value. And anything we can do to extend the life of a person, halachically we should do. Okay? Everyone got that? Okay? So I call that the maximalist opinion on end-of-life care. We should do everything we can to extend life. Okay. What do you guys think about that? Say what you think. There's no right answer, isn't it?
Yeah. So what's the consequence for not doing that?
You're over on Lo Samal Adam Reacha, let's say. You're over on the Isser. You're not on Lo Taro because you didn't do anything. But let's say Lo Tamal. Right, let's say you're over on Lo Samal Adam Reacha. Okay. It's an Isser, over on Isser, which is a bad thing. It's a big problem. We can't just be over Isser. Okay, what else do you guys think about that? Yes, Bailey.
Does Lo Samal Adam Reacha apply though if the patient is okay with you not doing anything?
That's an excellent question. And yes, he would say, here, he says, thank you. He would say you don't listen, yes. He says other people listen to the patient, you don't listen to the doctors. Yes, that's a very good question. Who decides? That's another sort of a related to this topic, but a different shear. Who decides? The doctor, the patient, the Kodesh Baruch Hu, or the Rav? Sitz Eliezer says the Rav decides in questions of medical Because okay, so right, so right, the patient can't abrogate that right. Okay. What else do you guys? Anyone have any? What do you think about it? Yes.
Because it's still as you're saying anything about brain death.
Yes, that. Right. That's an excellent. What's your name?
Yehuda Shekhar.
Yeah, excellent question, Yehuda. Now, whenever I teach medical ethics, Jewish medical ethics, to my students, I ask a question. I always say the answer is always the same. What's the answer in Jewish medical ethics to every single question, practically every single question?
Machlokas.
Exactly, machlokas. And it's not just subtle machlokas. It's machlokas on the extremes of the... And we can talk a little bit about... I can give you some examples. But we're not talking about a patient here who's brain dead. We are not talking about brain dead. But the Sitte Eliezer does not believe in brain dead. So it might be related to Pesach, might not, but here we're not talking about a patient who's brain dead. Okay, so that's it's related, but that he also says he doesn't believe in brain dead, but there's two different questions. The keeping someone alive who's not brain dead is a different question than defining when someone's dead, a brain dead question. Okay, any other? Yeah, anyone have any? Yeah.
So his proof in Shabbos.
Excellent, yes.
Involved no pain, as I was reading.
It's what?
Was there any pain involved in the patient there?
Yeah, he says, Gamkin in Sivlo. He really said, Vamarut Hazet. This is someone who's captured, who collapsed building. Hazet. But Arebavavet al Gimel Kashti Pula Chayshod Yerichalankin. Gamkin in Sivlo. He thinks the case is when the patient's suffering too. Okay, excellent question. Okay, now there's some, now that. Okay, so that's his opinion. Fine, that he believes in the sanctity of life, kedushat ha'chayim. That would probably be what we call his opinion. But now there are consequences to this. I'll just say one consequence. This opinion, if we took the Sitte Eliezer's approach in Israel, it would bankrupt the Israeli healthcare system. Okay, so I mean, right now I don't know. Now a posek has to address that issue. He didn't address that question. We don't have enough ventilators in my hospital to do what he wants us to do. And there's not enough money in the healthcare system to do that. Okay, that's a different question, how we allocate resources, but it's sort of a related kind of question. Because you look, but if some, like if you're the part of the healthcare minister, if you accept this PSOC, then you don't have money to build new hospitals, you don't have money to give vaccinations, you don't have money to treat drugs for leukemia. So because only limited amount of money in the healthcare budget, there's just not infinite money. Life might be of infinite value, but there's no infinite money. So you gotta square the circle, or I don't know, square the square. I don't know what you gotta do, but you gotta address that question. Okay, yes?
Does the Sitte Eliezer distinguish between withdrawing care once you're already on it versus not?
Excellent, excellent question. No, he does not. For him, this is excellent. You could withdraw, but he's talking about aggressive care, he's talking about active care. Now, withdrawal and active is sort of more in euthanasia, but okay. Yeah, the Sitte Eliezer is not talking about it. He's saying you have to do active actions. You have to do operations to extend someone's life, even for a couple of hours. That's the case. The case is doing an operation on the child. That's an active kind of act. What's your name?
Talia.
Excellent question. Okay. Any other? Yes.
Is there any sort of discussion about a very risky operation that, if successful,
yes,
for the next
term
life?
Excellent question. When do you allow to take the risk, like if you have an operation that's 20% mortality but 80% to extend life, do you have to take that risk? Yes, the post can talk about when are you allowed to do an operation with one risk kind of thing. Yes, that is part of the equation too. But we're talking about here where there's no risk, where the risk is minimal. That's the case we're talking about. But yes, there might be operations that are risky that you don't have to do, but that's because, not because you don't have to send life, because you might die immediately and then there's a little different reason. But excellent question too. Yes,
Faith. Right, so here we're just talking about, it's like a question of futility. Like even though the person is most likely...
The patient's going to die. The kid,
right,
is going to die.
But you still have to do something.
In hours or days, we're talking about, or weeks maybe. The child is dying. There's the facts are the child is dying, and there's no cure for his disease. Right? We're talking about extending life. 6 hours, I would say hours even. It's for him, there's no cutoff, because there's no days, weeks, that's what we're talking about. Okay. So that's the Sitz Eliezer's approach. Okay. Does modern medicine, secular medicine, take this approach? No, not really. They don't take this approach. Okay. That's all right. We can argue with that, but clearly they take a different kind of approach. Okay. So now let's see what Rav Moshe Feinstein says. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the sixth paragraph. This is from Choshen Mishpat, Chelik Bet, Ayin Gimel, if anyone wants to know the source. Okay. Hinei bedavar, im yesh anashim cholim ke'elim, she'ein latet lehem eza minei refuot la'arich chayem k'sat yoter. So they asked Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now Rav Moshe Feinstein didn't publish his questions, just to say, in the Gross Moshe. So, but this is a response to a question. A friend of mine, Dr. Ringel, and Dr. Jacobowitz, wrote this tshuva. I saw the letter that they wrote, published in a book in honor of Harry Jacobowitz on his retirement, the chief rabbi of Britain. They printed the question in that book. So you can see, and they asked him, are there times you don't have to extend, exactly the question we're dealing with, are there times you don't have to extend the life of patients? Can you let patients die? Okay, and the cases, let's talk, the case was that they're talking about is a patient with metastatic cancer who we don't have treatment for, who gets pneumonia or something, who gets a pneumonia. Do you have to treat the pneumonia in a patient who's dying of metastatic cancer? Let's say that's the question we're talking about. Do we have to always, now if Sitz Eliezer, it's not a question. The answer is yes, of course. This question would be one word according to Sitz Eliezer. Yes, there's no. Yeah, of course you have to do it. So he says he named the first b'ktuba reish daf kuf tet, but of the b'tiro shel the Rebbe. It's where's the answer? It's obvious. It's obvious from the case of the story of the death of Rebbe. Okay, now let's read the story. Everyone know the story of the death of Rebbe? Anyone know? Okay, we'll read the story of the death of Rebbe. Look on the turn on your page. I think, yeah, good. It's the 1, 2, 3, the fifth paragraph. This is from Ktubot Daf Kuftal. Yeah, Kuftal. I'm an Aleph. Hahu, this is the Gemara. Hahu Yoma Denach Nafshe De Rebbe. On the day that Rebbe died, Gazu Rabbana Tanisa. The Rabbana made a fast day. Uvayi Rachmana V'Amri. Kol man d'amar noach nafshe d'Rebbe yitkar b'cherem. Anyone who says Rebbe is dying will be stabbed with a sword. Okay, why did they say that?
Ayin hara.
What?
Ayin hara.
Yeah, Ayin hara, or they were in denial. Okay, fine, Ayin hara. Maybe Ayin hara and denial are similar things, but okay. But they were in denial. They didn't want to hear that anyone. Now Hayu Yoman, we know Rebbe died, so he was dying. There's no question. The first words of the story tell you that Rebbe's died. So, but they were in denial or Ayin hara. Silka Amsa de Rebbe Leigra, the handmaid of Rebbe, his housemaid. And there's a lot of stories about the housemaid of Rebbe. Okay, you know. Anyone? There's a place called Beit Shearim in Israel. Anyone know where that is? Anyone been there? Fascinating place in the Galil Tachton. We know where Rebbe's buried. We know his kever. It's not a question like I live in Beit Shemesh, like Kever Shimsho. Kever Shimsho is not Kever Shimsho. It's the grave of some old sheik. And then, like, Kever Shimsho, no one knew for 2,000 years where Shimsho died. It's not, maybe it is, but we have no Masorah where it is. But Rebbe, we know. This is his kever. We know he's buried in Beit Shearim. We know where, so you can see where is the kever of where Rebbe died. But the place is fascinating. It's an old Jewish burial. It's a very interesting place. So, Kol Man, right, so they say, so I'm to the Rebbe, Amra, she went to the roof, Amra, Elyonim Mivakshim et Rebbe, Vatachtonim Mivakshim et Rebbe, the angels want Rebbe, the Talmidim don't want Rebbe to die. Yiratzon Chi Akafu Tachtonim Esel Yonim. Like she made a she davened that the Tachtonim, the students will overcome the angels and Rebbe won't die. Okay, everyone got it? Everyone got it? What's going on? She went up, she said a prayer. I'm gonna daven with the students that Rebbe doesn't die. Kevin de Chazi Kama Zimna Dial Lebet Kisek, the Khalat Filmanach Lo Mustar. Now Rebbe died probably of cholera. Anyone know what cholera is? It's a diarrhea, it's an infectious disease with diarrhea. It's a diabetic disease, infectious disease. But there's other stories that people have written articles that he died of a GI disease. Probably cholera. Every time he had to take off his film, go to the bathroom, and he was suffering. So she saw this. Amra, Yehiratzon, she kafuat yomus tachtonim. She twitched her prayer, and she said, let Rebbe die. Let the angels yikafuat tachtonim. V'lo avishatik Rebbe milabai rachbanim. But the Talmidim were still davening, and Rebbe wouldn't die. What did she do? Shak lakuza shade mi'igra la'ara. Ishtek mirachme, the students died, the noach nafter the Rebbe. She threw down the vessel, the students were startled, they stopped davening, and Rebbe died. Okay, extra credit. Who does this sound like the story of the death of? Who said that? Who said David? David HaMelech, right. So what's the connection between Rebbe and David HaMelech? What? Exactly, it's a sentence. So obviously they're using the same story, but it's the same idea here. Rebbe was a descendant, so okay, fine. So that's just a side point. Okay, so this is the story of Moshe Feinstein quotes. Let's go back to the tshuva. Now we know the Gemara, now we're doing the tshuva. Can't learn the tshuva without knowing the Gemara. He b'dav, ne b'dav, ronesh alashim cholim ke'elim. She'ein li'tem lahem ezem minei refuot la'arichayim sarjari. Are there any patients who we shouldn't extend their life? He named the forest Bektuba Reish Daf Kodalib of the Tertos Rebbe. It's Mephorosh in the story of the death of Rebbe. Dabai Rachme, Ve'elu Tzulasim Shal Yamos. The Talmidim were davening and Rebbe didn't die. Avaloshis Rabbe. But he couldn't, he was dying. Ukisharasa Amsa, the Rebbe from the Star Tuba. When she saw he was suffering, Yiratzon Shiakafu El Yonim Esatach Tonim. I hope that the El Yonim, I hope the El Yonim will overcome the time. Vlavi Shatik Rabban America, Shakla Kuzi Shak, Nitish, the Krakmana, the Noach Tarafi. Vinakatzea Gemara. The Gemara tells this story, Lashmin Inyan, Sheik Alephayim, Shesarach, this Pahal Adam Kamishtair, the Ain Moli Mine Refos to Reposa, Utfilos Rabban's Kalu. If there are times that our Tfilos aren't working, Shesarach, this Pahal Al Yashayamus. And then we should die. We should pray in certain times that a person should die. Ki amsa de Rebbe Avi Chachamam Dinei Torah Yelam Dimena Rabbi Payim. Because the amsa de Rebbe was a Talmidei Chachama, and we learn other halachas from. I'll tell you the other halachas if I get a chance. What else we learn from her? Okay, and now we can skip a little. I don't want to do the okay, now four lines from the bottom. This is the key line of the tshuva of Rav Moshe. Uve inche ki ay gavna sharofim akirum she iyes sharlav sur latrap lichios. When they're patients who we can't cure, va'af shelo yichme kmoshi uchola belo yisurin, and we can't, and then they're suffering. Aval efshar liten lehem samini refuah larach yamav kmoshi nimsa to be sur, but we can't extend their life. Ain liten lamine refus el yanichem kamoshim. And Moshe says, don't give them those medicines that can extend their life, but leave them and let them die. Okay, so that's the tshuva of Moshe Feinstein. So what's it in relation to Rav Altenberg? It's pretty much the opposite. So obviously he's sort of Rav Waldenberg said there's no question that it's against the Torah and the mother is right and there's a chi of kamatur or Moshe. That's not true. There are times we can let a patient die. Okay? So that's the first point. Now let's put our thinking caps on. Okay? What's Rav Moshe Feinstein's proof for this chiddush, for this psak?
Basically equating prayer to action.
So that's one question. So that's the second level that I wanted to get to. Where does he bring his proof from? What?
A story.
Now, what's the problem with that?
Not halacha.
Not halacha. This is the most important psak in modern medical ethics. This psak, and Rav Moshe Feinstein brings the proof from a story. That's like unheard of. It's like changes every kol psak. Where's Shochar? Where's Shutim? Where's Gemara? How could he bring the psak from a story? Now, there are certain times that we do that we do paskin like stories, but to make this incredible, groundbreaking psak from a story is just an incredible leap that Rav Moshe Feinstein made. So the next tshuva in Rav Moshe Feinstein, now look at this one. In Ayin Dalet, I think someone writes to him, I think it's Rav Tenna, Rav Tenna's brother, Hitchadli levagesh bir no seif al tshuva, shekatavti le Dr. Ringel Yaakovich. You want to, the person's writing to Rav Moshe and basically doesn't understand the tshuva. How can you say that? This is that from this story. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, Uva emet lo riti hamichasos led to biro. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't see sparks that I need to explain myself. Shaloya muvan li hechira. I don't understand. Ketoa rechachom makom shishayach litos. I don't understand how you can make a mistake. Shere adin shekatafti udin mevur a pasha. It's pasha what I wrote. It's not even a question. Now who doesn't think it's pasha? What? Cecilia doesn't think it's Pashut, but Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks it's Pashut. Now here with the key lines again. Shem ein yodim harofim shum refuah lo rak lerfosu el afolek yisurim el harik sat chayav kamoshe yisurim ein lahem litei refuah keela. And he says it again. Sharei b'ki ha'gav d'chosim yuvda d'rebi. Shaloi li rebi t'filasam shah gulnasam. Exactly. He says exactly the same thing again. I don't understand what the problem is. What, it's Pasha. But there's obviously a big problem here. So first of all, a lot of times when they say it's Pasha, it means it's not Pasha. So that's it. Now, I think Rav Altmer also thought it was Pasha. So it's not Pasha. These questions are not Pasha. But Rav Moshe Feinstein thought it was Pasha. So the question is, so there are a lot of questions here. So the first question is that it's an unbelievable psak that based to make this groundbreaking psak based on a story from a Gemara. So a lot of times people say you don't pass on a story, only from other sources. Okay, but still, it's a very big leap that Rav Moshe Feinstein is making. And what's your name?
Yehuda.
Well, Yehuda said. The story is not talking about, is not, where did Rav Moshe Feinstein get this from? The story is not talking about medical treatment. The story is talking about davening. Question is, do you daven or not daven for a person? What does it have to do with medical treatment that we're talking about here? Okay, so what's the answer to that question?
Isn't that the equivalent of
right? Questions? Exactly. So either Rav Moshe Feinstein thought it's equivalent, number one, or number two. In those days, they didn't have medical treatment. They had tefillah. So whenever Rav Moshe Feinstein is making equivalent between tefillah and medicine, that's not pashut by itself too. Okay, what's another question that you can ask from this story?
The rabbi didn't agree.
Exactly. How do you know she was right? The rabbis didn't agree. How do we know that the Amta was right, what she did? The story doesn't tell us that, and all the rabbis disagreed with her. Okay, that's the second problem with it. What are the problems with the story? Yeah.
I mean, she specifically prayed for him, she died.
Like,
it wasn't like she
just
didn't do anything.
Ah, okay, well, this, and your little, Bailey, I'll extend your question a little. She did something active. It's not that she, like, you said she did something active that sort. Now she stopped the prayer. That active is not active, but it's not that she didn't treat. She did something active. Okay, so that's an interesting point. She did. Okay, and then another question is what was I thinking? Oh, she didn't ask anyone. Like you can just decide for someone else. Like, why don't they ask Rebbe what he wanted? How did she have the chutzpah to do this without asking Rebbe? So if someone's dying, I could say okay. I'm not going to treat you. You have to ask the patient, no? Even so, okay. So the psak, the end result is clear, or emotional biasing. Now, we probably couldn't practice modern medicine without the psak of it would be very difficult if we just had the psak of the Sitta Eliezer, it'd be very difficult for a firm doctor to work in any modern American hospital. It would be very, very difficult. So the Israeli end of life law follows Rav Moshe. I think most doctors. Where I personally follow my rabbeim, follow the psak of Rav Moshe. So it lets you practice some. Maramesa, we tend to be non-aggressive with dying patients, but the rationale is very difficult. Okay, but now I will tell you that I think Rav Moshe Farsi is right, that his shot in the story is the right shot in the story. Okay, now this is the point, because when you read a story in the Gemara, you can't just read it like a story, like a story, like we read stories. Just like we take a literary approach to learning Tanakh, right? People, you guys know about that kind of stuff. Anyone who learns modern kind of Tanakh, I also do a little bit of Tanakh on the side. Anyone looks at an article on Yonah, it's on the VBM. If anyone wants to look this, you don't care if everyone wants to look at my article on Yonah. Maybe someone I could pull a push for that. Tell me what you think about it. But I also learn a lot of Tanakh, and I teach Tanakh. But just like you also have to learn stories of the Gemara. They're work of art. They're not that when they're literary works of art, and there was great thought put into how you wrote the stories. So I'll tell you, I'll show you two examples. So let's read. We read the story. Ahil Yom Denoch Derafshi Gazer Rabban Tanis Yovai Rachmana Marmer Koman DeAmer Noach Nashi Refer Yitkar Bechera. Whoever said Rebbe is gonna die. Would be yitkar b'chara, will be stabbed with a sword. Okay, so I read this story tens, if not hundreds, of times, and fine, it never hit me. Until once I was learning Tanakh, Mishlei, and I came across this pasuk: Yesh boteh kemitkaret charev, v'lashon chachamim merape. So this is the only time in Tanakh where the dakar and charev come together. So the person now. How do I know that the person who wrote this story was referring to this pasuk in Mishlei? The rest of the pasuk, Balashon Chacham Merape. That's exactly what they were doing. They were davening. So the person who wrote this story had all of Tanakh in front of them, and they were able to put these two words together. And you're supposed to have, the reader is supposed to know that Yidkar B'charev is referring to a pasuk in Mishlei, which talks about Lashon Chacham Merape. I don't know how many readers do that, but it took me years till I made that connection. Okay. The other point, the story is written in a chiastic structure. Okay? How do I know the story is written in a chiastic structure? Because A and A repeated, it's Ahu Yoma, Denoach Nashi the Rebbe, and it ends, Ahu Yoma, Denoach Nashi the Rebbe. It starts and ends the same way. B and B are flips of each other, right? They flip each other, and they flip each other on what's happening. They're exactly mirror images of each other. She's praying, in the beginning she's praying that the Tachtonim will go about the Elyonim. In the end, she's praying the Elyonim will go with the Tachtonim. And every time you have a chiastic structure, what's the key of a chiastic structure? The middle. The middle is the key to the chiastic structure. So the key is this. Kevan dechazi kamazimye. When she saw how much Rebbe was suffering. Okay. Now, the point is here is that she saw what Rebbe was going through. Now, I didn't really understand, it also took me a long time to understand the story, is that what happens in the hospital is that nurses tell me all the time that we only know what's going on in the patient. Because I round in like 20 patients a day. I see, how much time do I have for each patient? You know, if it's lucky, 10 minutes. And that's, let's say, 10 minutes, 20. That's like 4 hours. That's, you know, and I have to do everything else. That, you know, that's, so I have the most, you know, 10 minutes, 5 minutes with some patients, 15 minutes if it's an extremely complicated patient. The nurses are with the patients all the time. And they tell me all the time, and they really know what's going on with the patient. And they know what the patient is feeling. And they know when the patients are suffering and what the patients are going through, much more than us doctors. That's exactly what the story is telling you, is that Kevan Dechazi, when she saw how much suffering Rebbe was going through, she understood that we shouldn't pray for him anymore, that it was time for Rebbe to die. Okay, now it gets more interesting than this. What do you think Rebbe was suffering from? Anyone? I sort of hinted at it. What was he suffering from? What? Yeah, what was the pain you think he was having?
GI
pain, right. That's what I thought. But Rashi doesn't learn that way. Rashi says that, what, anyone know?
The Tsar's feeling was that he had to keep taking off his tefillin.
Exactly. That was sort of, what's your name?
Talia.
But Talia was a little different. He said that he had to take on and off his tefillin. That the pain was taking on his tefillin, off his tefillin, because every time he went to the bathroom, he had to take on and off his tefillin. That was the pain that Rebbe was suffering. Now, why is Rashi right and I'm wrong? What?
A detail is clearly there and has no significance otherwise.
Exactly, because that's what the story says. Because if that wasn't the reason, why the story? Exactly. So that's why Rashi is right. But I have a question on Rashi. Why didn't Rebbe just not stop wearing? Why didn't he just stop wearing tefillin? And then he wouldn't suffer, and then he wouldn't have to die, and Shalom Yisrael. There's no chiv to wear tefillin all day. Once a day, okay, that's what we do nowadays. Why did Rebbe? Why didn't that solve the problem? So, anyone have an answer to that question? What?
It becomes a quality of life question.
You explain, Talia.
That if for Rebbe, what was meaningful in his life was to wear his tefillin in his religious life, then not being able to do that,
exactly.
Stopping wearing tefillin would not.
He wouldn't say he would stop being Rebbe. Right. So that's exactly, I think, the point. I agree 100% with Talia. What Talia said is that if Rebbe would stop, if anyone reads, Rebbe was very connected to tefillin. If anyone wants to look up stories, you could search Rebbe and tefillin. Rebbe, his identity was tied up with wearing tefillin. And if Rebbe would stop wearing tefillin, he would lose his identity. And we don't require a person to lose their identity. So now I'm going to ask a more complicated question. Where does this identity issue come up a lot in modern medicine? A patient's losing identity. Who said Alzheimer's? Okay, yes, exactly. That is a major, major issue in patients with Alzheimer's, is that there's a big loss of, there's a major issue for them is loss of identity. And they stop being who they are. And how do we relate to that halakhically? I'll sort of maybe have time a little bit to talk about the end. But I think that's what's going on in the story. She saw that Rebbe was suffering. She was with Rebbe. And the Torah and the halakha doesn't require someone to suffer by losing their identity. Okay, so now we can get a little complicated. The story also goes from the masculine to the feminine. Maybe I'll explain to that in a little while. Okay, now why? How did the handmaid have the gall to do this? Where did she learn? Where'd she learn this from? So this, I think she learned this from Rebbe himself. Rebbe taught her this lesson. And there's a Gemara in Bava Metzia. That's the next. And what's the da? I think it might be Sama. I'm not sure exactly. I think it's Samach or Ayin. I don't remember exactly where it is. Where the Gemara has this story. Yisurin de Rebbe, Al Yidei Maisa Bo, Al Yidei Maisa Halchu. Rebbe's suffering, where did they come from? Al Yidei Maisa Bo Mahi. There was a little calf that was supposed to be shochet. Azel talia l'reisha b'kanfei de Rebbe. The calf ran away and hid under the cloak of Rebbe. The karbechi and the calf started crying. Amr le zil l'kach nosrat. Rebbe said, "Get out of here! You're supposed to be shechted." Amre, I think the malachim and the batkol. Ho v'lo kam rachim lesa lav yisurim. Because you were not marachim on this little calf, Rebbe, you're going to have yisurim. V'aydei maisa holchu, and Rebbe got better. How? Yom chad avikar kanchda Rebbe beza. One day our ama, this handmaid, our same handmaid from Gmorim Ksubas, was sweeping. Havishadye bnei Krishna. She was sweeping the mice out of the house, and she was hurting them. Amar le Shavkinan. Rabbi said, stop hurting the mice. K'tiv v'rachamav al kol ma'asav. Because the pasuk says, v'rachamav al kol ma'asav. Amreho merachem, merachem aleha. Because you, Rebbe, had mercy on the mice, I am going to have mercy on you. And as you threw him, stop. So Rebbe taught the Amta the Rebbe the level of the lesson of a racham of a kol ma'asav. So maybe it's just a speculation. Maybe when she saw how Rebbe had this taught her this element of rachamim, that caused her to have the rachamim of Rebbe. Okay, now I said that the story goes from the masculine to the feminine. Why does the story, okay, start with the masculine and end with the feminine? Okay, anyone is a literary pro? Talia?
Does this connect to what you wrote about Sefer Yonah or no?
No.
Because it happens there also.
About the machlokas between Emes and the Rachamim and Din. Is that the Emper Dalit? Okay.
No, I wasn't making that example, but that's also true.
Okay. Wait, where is it? Tell me Sefer Yonah. I like
Dag and Dagah.
Oh, Dag and Dagah, right. That there's two, the Rashi there, the guy of the dog, because there's two squished, yes. There's two things. The prayer is before and after. You can look at my article. I write about that. Okay, fine. And then there's, okay, yes. Dag and Dagah are excellent examples of that. Okay, fine. No, but he was too comfortable. Rashi says he was too comfortable in the dug, so and he was just sitting there having a good time. So Rashi, they put him in the dugah. It was all cramped in there, and then he started doing tshuva. Well, that's what Rashi says, in Yonah. Okay, but no. So how does the story go from the masculine to the feminine? And I'll tell you how it's related to medical ethics too. Okay. Well, you can take a guess. The first line is very masculine, the last line is very feminine. Why is that? Okay, I'll say. Maybe I'm wrong, okay? That I wrote an article about this in Modern Judaism, if anyone's interested, you could probably find it somewhere. The rabbis make rules. Okay, who makes rules? In Judaism, do women make rules or men make rules? Men make rules. The rabbis make rules. Those are the, and that's exactly what it says here. Gazra b'nei. The rabbis made a rule, and they used a very masculine yithkar b'charav. They used a knife, which is a sword, which is a very masculine kind of it brings object. And in the end, she shakla kuza. She threw a vessel, a pottery vessel, which was a kitchen kind of utensil. That's what she threw to the ground. And then she becomes the center. In the first line, the rabbis are the center, who make rules, who stab people. In the end, it's the handmaid who uses a kitchen utensil to have rachma and Rebbe. Okay, that's my contention. Okay, but why is this important? Okay? It's important because there's something called feminine medical ethics. Anyone hear of that? Hear of that? Okay. Let's start back. Anyone hear of Carol Gilligan? Yes. Okay. What book did Carol Gilligan write?
Oh, I forget the name of her book, but I know she wrote this one.
In a Different Voice.
Okay.
Okay. Carol Gilligan wrote a book in a different voice. I think she's at NYU. So she wrote a book in the 1960s called A Different Voice. And what she claimed is that women and men think differently about ethical problems. That's what she claimed. She's a developmental psychologist. She was studying for a PhD at Harvard in the 60s. And what she did, what they were doing is, they were doing all these developmental surveys on they had these ethical surveys to see to rate how ethical people are. And it came out that men were much more ethical than women in how they approached ethical problems. And Carol Gilligan said, no, It's not that, that men are more ethical. It's that women think differently than men about ethical problems. And this was her example. She brought this example. They did a survey. If your child is hungry, is it ethical to steal from the grocery store to cure your son's your son's hunger or your child's hunger? So the answer ethically is no. That because there's a rule, don't steal, and that's what and ethics have to follow rules, and the rule is don't steal, and there's no exceptions. Don't steal is the rule. So all the men said don't steal, and the women said that in certain instances you can break the rule. It's ethical to break the rule, and all the development psychologists before Carol Gilligan said that proves that men are more ethical. They follow the rules, women don't follow. And Carol Gilligan said, no, it's that women think differently about ethical issues, and this is where feminine ethics was, it's a field. Feminine ethics is also called care ethics. Nell Nonnings, if anyone's interested. This is sort of what I do as a professor of ethics. I deal with this kind of stuff. But that's what, now, so Carol Gilligan said, now students of Carol Gilligan said, it's not that they argued on their teacher and said it's not that women think differently than men, it's that certain people think differently than other people. So that's a machlokes in theories of ethics, and that I'm not an expert in, whether it's a woman-man thing or it's a different person thing. Okay, I don't know the answer, but that's a machlokes in developmental psychology, that question. But she wrote her book in a different voice, and she also extended it to abortion, this is what she claimed. The question is abortion ethical, moral or not, is the question. So it depends on the simple question that is the child. Abortion is a simple, quite ethical problem. It's not a complicated one. Is the fetus a person or not? So if the fetus is a person, it's murder to kill. If the fetus is not a person, then you might be allowed, for some instance, to do an abortion. That's the thing. Now, who argues on this? Anyone, now we can take a little parenthesis. Anyone knows what the Jewish approach to abortion is? So I told you what the answer is. Machlokes. So now it's interesting. Rav Moshe Feinstein and Sitzel Ezra have the opposite views on abortion, but they split. Rav Moshe Feinstein is very, very machmir on abortion. He says, you know, certainly after 40 days, the only heter to do an abortion is if the mother's life is in danger, and even before 40 days, he says. Sitzel Ezra says you can do an abortion, even third trimester abortions. In he's matches abortions in Tay-Sachs, even matches abortions in Down syndrome, and even abortions, matches abortions in the case of adultery or if the mother he's very why, because he doesn't think the fetus is a person. He says pashut, Rav Waldberg does not think the fetus is a person until birth. Moshe Feinstein thinks the fetus is a person at conception. So that's their machlokes. But it's interesting. It's the not they're it depends how you call it, but. Rav Waldenberg is it doesn't matter who you call it, but Rav Moshe Feinstein is more protective of the fetus, and Rav Waldenberg is much less. And a lot of post-Knesset Yisrael used to send their abortion questions to Rav Waldenberg. And he was consistent about it. He wrote tens of tshuvos. He says the same thing, that abortion in certain instances is halachically permissible. He has a list of things. So Moshe Feinstein is basically never, only if the woman's life is in danger. So Carol Gilligan said this. So that's the question. It's a simple ethical question. Carol Gilligan said no. It depends the context of the situation. Is that Carol Gilligan was Mechadish. Now, if you have a rich, let's say you have a baby with Down syndrome. If you have a two-parent family where they have resources and they can care for the baby, then abortion might be immoral in that situation. But if you have a single mother who's on welfare, who has no ability to care for the baby, then abortion might be moral in that situation. So it depends on the context of the situation. And that's what feminine ethics looks like. They don't look at just the rule, they look at the situation and they take into account the context of the relationships and the family situation and the psychological aspects and the sociological. That's all part of what should be part of a feminist ethics approach. While a man would just follow a rules called deontology or God praise. So what I claim is that the Amt to the Rebbe was the first feminist ethics. So Carol Gilligan did not Mechadesh. The Amt to the Rebbe Mechadesh this idea of feminist ethics. And she said, you have to look at the context of the situation. sometimes it's right to pray for a person to die when the person is suffering. It's not just like Rav Alderbrook said, you always have to extend life. You have to look at the context of the situation. And the context of the situation showed that Rebbe was suffering. And when the patient is suffering, you don't have to extend life. And maybe she learned that from the actions of Rebbe. Okay. Everyone got that? Questions on that? Okay. Now, just we have 5 more. Okay. I'll just do 2 more things. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein, again, every question you have to ask a Rav, because they're complicated life and death questions, and a lot of times a good posek will be consult with the physician. It has to be, because good psak, starts with good medicine. You can't give a good psak unless you know the medicine facts. That's what you have to. A doctor can't give the psak, but the Rav needs to know the medical facts. So I get a lot of calls from Rabbeim just to help to clarify the medical facts before you make a psak on that. So Rav Moshe Feinstein said there's 2 conditions that you can use that you don't have to extend life. The patient has to have a terminal illness, and the patient has to be suffering. If you read the tshuva, that. So what's the problem with those 2 debt points?
For the terminal illness, we already covered up in the hall of Shabbos situation how even if you're able to extend it like
a Ah, excellent. So that's the question of Rav Altenberg. Maybe it depends if Shabbos is Hutra Dechuya. I don't want to get, you can invite me to give a shiur on Hutra Dechuya at some other time. But maybe that Rav Altenberg says it's Dechuya, and then so maybe that's the way how Rav Moshe can answer. But that's not what's so funny. Yeah, Rav Soloveitchik and Halachic Man writes about it. Life is, yes, if you want to look at that, writes a lot about that, about the idea of Hutra Dechuya. Okay, so, right, the supreme value of life in Judaism, okay. So, so that's an excellent point, yes.
So is there like a degree of suffering?
Right, how do you define terminal illness? How do you define suffering? Those are the 2 questions that... Great, so Moshe Feinstein says that terminal illness and suffering. Okay, so how do you define suffering? So that's a very, very difficult question then. That Moshe Feinstein just says, but every... So Shlomo Zalman says, even psychological suffering could count for defined suffering. So how do you define suffering? Because everyone's pain is tolerance. That's a very, very difficult question. How do you define the level of suffering? Because everyone's different. And the other question is, how do you define someone who has a terminal illness that the patients that we can't cure? We are not good at doctors at prognosing who has a terminal illness. That's just that. And I've been doing medicine for 25 years, and all I do is take care of dying. But not all I do. I take care of patients. All I do is take care of patients in the hospital. I don't do outpatient medicine. I just do hospital medicine, and a lot of our patients die. That's just part of life, and that's part of what I take care of. But we are not good at prognosticating who's going to die, when they're going to die. Those are kind of hard, difficult questions. So how do you do that? And then I'll ask you another question: is Alzheimer's disease a terminal illness? That's sort of a question that's a very difficult, complex question. That metastatic cancer we know, end stage heart failure. Lung disease, kidney disease, liver disease, but is Alzheimer's disease? In certain cases, yes, probably yes, but no. Again, every case is different, but that's a question that we have to deal with. Okay, I'm just going to finish with one more story, because this was, I called this, what did I call it, Bailey? Talmudic narratives or something?
Talmudic narratives.
Okay, so we're going to, one last story. Matzil Rabbi Chananya ben Tradyo. Yoshev Osek Umakil Kilos Rabin, the Sefer Torah Munoch Lobachenko, the Avilo Vikorcha Besefer Torah, the Kiyo Bechavle. Everyone knows the story of Chaim ben Tradya. We just read it on Yom Kippur, right? The story of him dying. And they wrapped him up. Now, why is this? You'll see, everyone knows why it's important. Okay, important to our story. They put cotton so he wouldn't die quickly. Kadesh Lotetay Neshamasomehira. Amrlo Bito, his daughter said, Abba Recha Bakach. Amrlo Ilem Aninis Rafti Levadi. I had the Rakash Liaksha. Nisro for Sefer Torah, me Vakash Obono, shall Sefer Torah, we Vakash Obono. Amrlo, so he said, his daughter, don't worry. I'm going to be all right. Whoever's going to get vengeance for the Sefer Torah will also take care of me. Amrlo Talmidav, his student says, Rabbi Mata Omer, Amalem Gilian Nisraim Belsrechin Porechas. The beautiful metaphor that the cloth is burning, but the letters are flying up to heaven. Now they told him, Afata Ptach Piv, Vatinas Bechi. Aish, open your mouth, the Aish will come in, and you'll die sooner. It's better that HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides where I'm going to die, and I can't do anything to harm myself. Amrlo Consolatorinary. The executioner says, Rebbe, and when he marbe b'shal heves v'notos fukin shal semer me'al l'vicha, atam me'vi l'chaim haba, if I raise the flame and take off the cotton, and you die quicker, will I go to olam haba? Amrlo Hain, yishabali, nishpah lo miyad harbe b'shal heves v'notos fukin shal semer me'al libo, yatsa nishmato mehera, afu kafaz v'nafu l'tocha or, yatsa ba'kal v'amra. Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion v'kal tzutinori muzman l'chaim haba. Bacha Rebbe of Amr, Yesh Kona Olami B'sha Achaz, Yesh Kona Olami B'kama Shanim. The executioner went with Rebbe to Olam Abba together. The Marsha says that they had equal share of Olam Abba, and that's where Rebbe died. Okay, so what's the problem with the story? Exactly, contradicts each other. The story contradicts each other. He told his Talmidim, I don't want to do anything. And he told the executioner to raise the flame. So a lot of people have tried to So which part of the story does the Sitz Eliezer like? What? The first part, right? He quotes the first part all the time. All the time he quotes it. And which parts of Rav Moshe Feinstein like? He likes the last part. So they each have their proof from the story, but the story contradicts each other. So a lot of poskim try to say it. One's active, one's passive. Opening your mouth is active. Maybe the non-Jew can do it. Maybe it's lo tam al dam recha by a non-Jew. It's very complicated sugya. But I have a chiddush in the story, and I think and this has to do because I've worked as a doctor for 25 years, and you might not get it, but maybe I'll be able to convince you that. And it only came to me recently, this Krishna story, is the story is purposely internally contradictory. The story knows exactly that it's contradictory. And why is that? Because patients are contradictory. Because patients tell different things to different people all the time. I can't tell you how many times that I've had end-of-life discussions with a patient, and they tell me one thing, and they tell their daughter a different thing, and they tell their grandson a different thing, and they tell their students a different thing. Because people are complex, and they tell people a lot of times not what they want, but what they want other people to hear. And then that's why the story is contradictory. Because the patient is contradictory, because patients contradict themselves all the self. So the stories ring so true to me as a doctor that this is a true story. It's not because this is a story of exactly what happened. Because patients tell different things to different people. That's what the story says. Ah, now we have to learn from it. That's a different question. That's what we have to figure out. That's where Moshe Feinstein took one part, Sisselzer took one part. But the story itself is purposely contradictory. Okay. So
what do we do with that?
What do you mean, what do we do with that? That's us. That's an excellent question. So what do I do? Let me just see where I'm just done. Where did I have my bag?
Oh, it's under the chair.
Oh, there it is, under my chair. Right, so what do I do? Right, so that's the difficult part of what I do as a doctor. I have to try to figure out what the patient really wants. So a lot of times I'll go alone to the patient. That takes experience to Right. A lot of end of life issues are not ethical issues. They're a lot of communication issues. And if you want to do end of life care, very good. These are the ground rules. But the most important part is talking to the patient and their family, and that takes a lot of experience and years of training. And I like that part about being a doctor. Isn't that not just the end of life stuff, but talking. There's a famous quote that this famous Dr. Francis Peabody wrote he said this about 90 years ago, that the secret of caring for the patient is caring for the patient. And I think that rings a lot of true, is that statement. Okay, well, thank you very much. You guys, questions about what I talked about medicine in Israel? Anyone have any questions? Yeah.
So you spoke about the Israeli law.
Right.
So what is that exactly?
Excellent question, Bailey. So Israel, you don't have to treat the Israel law follows Rav Moshe Feinstein that if the patient wants, you don't have to treat a dying patient. They define the dying patient as someone who's going to have 6 months to live. You don't have to treat a dying patient. They don't follow the Sitzel Ezra, they follow Rav Moshe Feinstein Psak. But you are not allowed, you can withhold care according to Israeli law, but you can't withdraw care. That Israel is the only country in the world that you can't remove a patient from a ventilator. That it happens every day in American hospitals, is that a patient's on a ventilator. In some states you can. And we could talk a different time about euthanasia and passive euthanasia and all that kind of stuff. In some, it's become legal in a lot of states now. But in New York, you can't do for now. I think it's up for discussion. As a matter of fact. But in certain states, you can't do physician-assisted suicide. But every state, you can't do anything active, but you're allowed to remove the ventilator because they don't think it's active. But in Israel, you're not allowed to remove a patient from a ventilator. That's how it's different in terms of that. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I have stuff about my medical. So I'm also the dean of a medical school, and wants to go to medical school in Israel. You can come talk to me about that. We have a great medical school in Israel. 25% of our students last year made Aliyah and stayed in Israel. So we like students to stay in Israel if they want. So if anyone's thinking about Aliyah and doctor, our school's a good place. Yes?
For
pregnant women?
Oncology.
Well, it's more prenatal screening. Yes, there's a lot of genetic screening being done, and also for oncology. Prenatal screening is to look at the health of the fetus. That's for one thing. And in cancer patients, we look to help tailor treatment. So we're very aggressive in that. Okay, so we have questions if anyone wants to. Thank you very much. Really impressed.